like to read with you three passages, and I'll explain how they link together, though you may see it as we read them. The first of them is from Mark chapter 2, verses 18 through 22. What I have here is, it's exegetical, but it's especially reflective. I'd like to put out a few thoughts for you that are not, they're not disjointed, but they're with an emphasis on the reflective for your consideration. You'll see how. Mark 2, verses 18 through 22. John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting, and they came and said to him, to Jesus, that is, why do John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but yours don't? And Jesus said to them, while the bridegroom is with them, the attendants of the bridegroom don't fast, do they? So long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast. The days are going to come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and they will fast on that day. And though I know you don't need it, I affirm this. We have a family wedding coming up next weekend, and meals have been a major part of that planning. Matthew chapter 6, verse 1, and then I'll jump down to verse 16. Matthew 6, verse 1. Jesus makes some applications about the inner righteousness that's in chapter 5, and he starts to connect it with some particular things. He says in 6:1, beware of practicing your righteousness before men in order to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. Verse 16, and whenever you fast, don't put on a gloomy face as hypocrites do, for they neglect their appearance in order to be seen fasting by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you fast, anoint your head, wash your face, so that you may not be seen fasting by men, but by your Father who's in secret. And your Father who sees in secret will repay you. And one more, Acts chapter 13. This is a preface to the first missionary journey. Acts 13, the first three verses. There were at Antioch, Syrian Antioch, in the church that was there, prophets and teachers, Barnabas and Simeon, who was called Niger, Lucius of Cyrene, Manaen, who'd been brought up with Herod the Tetrarch, and Saul, and they were ministering to the Lord and fasting. And the Holy Spirit said, set apart for me Barnabas and Saul for the work to which I've called them. And then when they had fasted and prayed and laid their hands on them, they sent them away. And there was the beginning of the first missionary journey. A couple of years after we moved to Beaver Falls and I was pastoring there, I was approached by a faculty member in the English department, and he knew that I have worked a lot in languages and linguistics, and with a kind of a nervous smile on his face, he said, I have a proposition for you. We have a course on the technicalities of English grammar. It's a required course for certain students. He said, the students hate the material. They hate the course. They hate the faculty member who teaches the course. Are you interested? And I thought, sure, because you could only go up from that point. You have nothing to lose. But I was thinking about that. I was thinking about that when I got a request, among some others this summer, to preach on the topic of fasting. And I don't know how many years I have preached on that topic. I think I can safely say, like some of you, it's not a favorite topic. I'm not saying I hate it, but it's not a comfortable topic. I like food. I like steak, lobster, shrimp, sushi, ice cream, chocolate. And the list goes on. It's a long list. And it's hardly a popular topic, you know, to talk about fasting. And I thought, let me just reflect on it a little bit with you in some ways that I hope will be helpful, because I'm stuck, as you are stuck, with this thing that Jesus says a couple times in Matthew 6, not if, but when. He just seems to assume that it's out there. And that's generally the way the Bible goes at it. And I can identify some not really good reasons to fast, as you can. I can think of things like being proud, and actually Jesus references that in Luke 18. Maybe you're saying to yourself, well, if I do this, I'll lose some weight. And some of us are happy to do that. Some of us don't need to. Others do. But that's not a good reason for, at least not for a religious fast. I know people who fast, there's a hurtful, damaging self-control issue, and I sort of acknowledge that, and I hope to stay away from that. But it is interesting to me that not only does Jesus assume it out there, but do you realize one of the earliest documents we're in possession of outside the New Testament itself, the Didache, which dates from the very end of the first, early couple decades of the second century, also is already addressing fasting. That's rather interesting the way it does it, by the way. The Didache, if you haven't read the Didache, it's kind of a mixture of pieces right out of the Gospels and then some other traditions attributed, rightly or wrongly, to the oral traditions of the apostles. But what's interesting is the Didache says, you make sure as a Christian you fast on these particular days of the week and avoid the days that the Pharisees fast. So they saw fasting as a separation from Pharisees. But I'm frankly a little bit nervous about it, and that's kind of why I wanted to just take it on here in a way I hope it is helpful. Some years ago, I was encouraged by some friends connected, interestingly, with a seminary to read one of the best-known Quaker writers of the 20th and 21st century, Richard Foster, in his book Celebration of Discipline. I like some of the things in that book. And the very first time I was navigating that book, I got to the chapter of fasting and I simply left it closed for a while, because I deep inside then and still, I don't want someone telling me this is how you have to do it. And I was happily disarmed when Foster said, when I finally had the guts to open it up and read it, he says on his very first page, he acknowledges that, and these are his words, whenever there is a form devoid of spiritual power, law, and he's meaning legalism when he says law here, law will take over because it always carries with it a sense of security and manipulative power. And I appreciated that comment because I'd heard people say things you ought to do. And I know there's an ought in there, but I just needed to hear something more and hear some thoughts about that. You all know in general what fasting is, and we nearly always reference it to food for the obvious reason that it's a good thing that we normally do and normally enjoy and should do. It's a good thing. But you can play with some other possibilities. I'll mention a few, but I won't linger on them. You might, try fasting from people. In other words, there are many of us who are what I call people saturated. We can count in the course of the day, if we were counting, hundreds and hundreds of conversations from early morning to early evening, and keeping a little bit of a distance occasionally from people. Yeah, that's a kind of fasting. Fasting from media, especially if you are addicted to your cell phone or your laptop. Fasting from shopping, or fasting from what you consider to be the necessities of life that may be luxuries, in fact. There's lots of ways to play it out. Although usually we go with food. Let's stick with that for now. It's an interesting idea. You can have something more by having something less. All right, that's not too crazy an idea. You can have something more by having something less, because sometimes when you have the something less, you start to become aware of some of the bigger and more enduring issues of life. It's generally a private matter, and Jesus shows that in Matthew 6. Do it so God is interacting with you and you're not trying to impress someone else. But there are group fasts sometimes, and we want to admit that there's certainly a place for that. You have that in Acts 13. You probably have that in places like Daniel 10. And we all know about Jesus' absolutely extraordinary 40-day fast. And I don't encourage that to anyone. I know a few people who have done it and who have survived it, a couple who have done it at various intervals in life, but that is quite a challenge. And people have said to me, you ought to do that. And I will be happy to tell you, I've never come close. And I don't see it happen, at least not in the near future. But I will tell you a surprise, and then I'm going to continue with some application here. A place for fasting. Jesus once talked to his apostles about an exorcism that wasn't happening. They'd seen exorcisms happen, and there's a stubborn situation recorded in Matthew chapter 9, where the apostles thought they could, because they'd done it before apparently, drive out a demon, and it didn't happen, at least not first. The situation was not being helped. And Jesus said, this kind, he didn't explain what he meant, this kind only comes out with much prayer and fasting. And for the first time ever in my life, I've only seen a handful of these kinds of situations, but for the first time ever, just a few years ago, saw one of them where it was over a period of many months and many people fasting for a particular woman that she was freed from the demonic troubles that she was in. But let's think more generally for a couple minutes. Why fast at all? What do you get for it? Start with something easy. Acts 13 helps us with that. You are going to focus on something of bigger importance. In this case, what's God wanting the early church at Antioch to do? Isn't that interesting, by the way? Antioch, not the mother church, but Antioch is cued into that, while the mother church seems to be tied up with internal struggles. There was an outward-looking attitude in Antioch. The problem with this is, I had many people say to me, well, when you fast, you're freed up to focus on that thing that's more important. Now, I'm going to ask you something. I have an answer for this. I want to see what you would answer. When you are really hungry, are you free from distraction? Hardly. In fact, the distraction is worse. I started to become very cynical some years ago. How can people say it'll free me up? I mean, fast food restaurants, fast food at home, takes about a minute to quick cook something. It's not much time. And I'd be much more focused on prayer if I wasn't growling inside. But let's try something else, a variation that maybe is a little closer to home. Matthew 5. Here's Jesus prior to what we just read, talking about the advantages. Think about this. Blessed are those who are poor in some way, and most of us don't yearn to be poor in any way. Blessed are those who mourn, and unless you're weird, you don't yearn to be sad. And blessed are those, if I could paraphrase the rest, who are vulnerable. And most of the time we're protecting ourselves. We're not opening ourselves to vulnerability. That's just part of human protectionism. It's an inclination. It's built deep into us. So maybe being vulnerable, being without, being sad, being broken, being vulnerable in ways that we are willing to do, not because we're forced into them, but because we choose to step into them, start to help us rebalance and start to think about what things really do matter. We rely on things every day. We rely on the use of natural resources, whether it's food and drink, electricity, space, movement, it's all these things. We rely on these things, no problem. But are we balanced in our use of them? I want to suggest that fasting helps to throw us off a little bit and question our relationship not only with God, but with the world, not only with our Creator, but with the good things the Creator has given us. And that's a dimension that isn't as much talked about. Let me add one more. Fasting and mourning. That seems to make sense. In fact, I know a number of people, I'm not one of them, but I know a number of people who, when they are emotionally upset, they find it very easy to go without food. Okay, there seems to be a link there. Jesus talks about the bridegroom. You all know the imagery. You know it very well. While he's there, you party. When he's gone, and it's not quite the exhilaration, the presence of the moment, that's the time to be sad. Maybe part of fasting opens us up to a kind of solidarity with others who are in sadness. And they are experiencing discomfort. And we choose for a season not to step into the simplicity of life, just the opposite, into the discomfort of a life at that moment, not relying on the familiar things. It's interesting, as I was preparing this initially, the initial part of this summer, I fell into a conversation with a gentleman who's a rather well-known pastor in the greater Pittsburgh area. He's had a very interesting ministry over the years. And he was telling me about a retreat he had been on, where they'd gone. He'd been with a bunch of pastors on this retreat. And he said to me, a little bit nervously, he said, "You know, I don't usually use these words," he said, "but our retreat and our short time of fasting," he said, I'm quoting him here simply, he said, "I experienced God." And I asked him a little bit about what he meant by that, and we talked about it. And then I asked him this question. I didn't tell him what I was preparing, what I was working on. I just said, "Can you tell me, what was the role of your fasting in that experience?" And he paused for a second, and this was his answer. He said, "It added to my week of total disconnection, disorientation, and disequilibrium." Wasn't that interesting? In other words, he was extracted out of his work routines. He was extracted from the media. He got no cell phone service where this retreat was being held. The perfect place for a retreat, right? He was extracted from everything he was familiar with, all the patterns that set his life, which are otherwise good patterns. And he said, and that it was just one day of fasting mixed into that utter disequilibrium. And he found in that he was more open to God. In some ways, he wasn't normally open. I thought that was interesting. So, a few thoughts to wrap. In fasting, the central issue always is our relationship to Jesus. That's the easy part, in a sense. I mean, knowing that should be our relationship to Jesus. If that's not somehow being helped, why do it? Nobody else is benefiting, at least not obviously, from your fast. But if your relationship to Jesus gets clarified, gets unified, gets firmed, if by the messing up of other familiar things you are that much closer to Jesus, that's a great thing. And part of that thing is by messing with your relationship with the world, the familiar world around you. Mess with that, and maybe you're a little bit freer here. I was interested by a comment made by, and by the way, the comment's not about fasting, it's about prayer, but it seems to me there's a parallel. It's by Leonard Ravenhill, who made this comment. Now, he's speaking about prayer, obviously. He says, "The self-sufficient don't pray. The self-satisfied won't pray. The self-righteous cannot pray." And it's interesting the way he links that link we have with God to the way we're linked to the things around us. And I wondered if there wasn't an application of that as well. To listening to God's voice sometimes requires a disruption of the way we listen to the voice of our day-to-day world. It's a good voice to hear, by the way. That's what the wisdom literature tells us. It's not a bad voice. But we sometimes have to disrupt that relatively easy-to-hear voice in order to hear that harder-to-hear, still, certain, slow light, as Elizabeth Elliot once called it. But if messing with this buys us this, that's a good deal, isn't it? Father, help us to do that appropriately, in a way that is true to our conscience on the one hand, but might be open to the things that we know you speak, so that whenever we might step into this experience, even for a single and very, very short and passing season, it might have a good role in inclining us to the heart of the Spirit. Jesus, I pray that for myself and for the men and women here. Amen.